The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors: Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card that generates leads. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet and Fetch Pro, the secure, high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. And Printify, the online, on-demand print shop for all your corporate merchandise. Be sure to visit our online store and get your own podcast merch. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
If I launch a podcast and the episode is really good, I'll start messaging people saying, hey, this is like, I'm proud of this. Just like, you like podcasts? Love a review.
Check it out. Right.
And it might not sound like a lot, but two or three reviews every day for a year.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you've got 1,000 reviews and that's pretty legitimate.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of this stuff is long. I learned very early on, right? It's a long game and you got to have, and look, you and I both know, what is there, 1.5 million? Probably pushing on 2 million podcasts now. They're coming up every day, but very few of them are consistent where they're always putting out episodes. And I don't know what the statistic is, how many actually remain, you know, active. But it's not, you know, it's not 100%. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, but that's also one of the beauties of the medium is you can do a season of 8 episodes and they're still around for the next decade and people still listen.
Yeah, they stay hanging.
You don't have to keep publishing all the time.
Right.
I think that the number of active podcasts that have had 2 episodes or more released in the last, say, 90 days is drastically lower. Yes, there are podcasts, but they're not still getting
any
downloads or really any sort of engagement.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, well, it's the same thing as any other content, right? A lot of people don't stick with things. And I think that, like you said, if you can't get 3 Google reviews and expect that to do something for you, but if you keep getting 1 a day or, you know, 1 every couple of days and it starts to build and then you have 1,000, that now you got some, now it starts doing what you want it to do, right?
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit beinhackerlaw.com or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hey, I'm Lucas Walker. I'm a serial entrepreneur, currently the founder, CEO, and multi-podcast host with the Rolled Up Podcast Network. You may know me from some of my time at Gorgeous, possibly as an e-commerce entrepreneur with the natural dog treat brand Treats Happen, or as the co-founder of the infographic maker Vengage. If you want to learn a little bit more about me, head down the rabbit hole. There's a ton of content out there that I've produced over the years.
All right, Lucas. So thank you for coming on my show. I know you're a big podcaster. We'll talk about your shows and the network you're a part of and all that stuff in a little bit. But you're up in Canada?
I am up here in Toronto. So home of the 2019 world champion Toronto Raptors, which, like Lauren Michael says, if you don't have a joke, at least have a fact. They were the longest consecutive champion without winning back-to-back titles because of COVID. It pushed out the next title being crowned. So in terms of consecutive days,
so they've held the Raptors title longest.
Longest annual champion for over 370 days or whatever, more than a year is.
Right. Well, hopefully there'll be no opportunities for people to break that because that would be bad, probably, right?
Still not the defending champs, but
like another pandemic.
So that's what people know Toronto for, and crack smoking mayor Rob Ford.
All right, well, I appreciate that. So, I was looking. I think we got connected through maybe a PR guy or one of the websites, right?
Connecting some podcasters. We met a couple. I don't know, it was weeks or closer to a month ago. But met a few weeks ago. And that's how we got connected as a couple of podcasters.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, you know, with all the entrepreneurs that I talk to and all the entrepreneurial, let's use the word coach for lack of a better term, but you know, the people that mentor and motivate and inform and educate other entrepreneurs, you're the first guy that I really met that really focuses on e-commerce. I mean, everybody, I guess, kind of dabbles in it, right?
But I mean, everything's e-commerce now, and that's what I found.
Don't you focus strictly on a lot of businesses that are only e-commerce, right? That's their only way.
Like Shopify, BigCommerce, Magento. You're selling products, like this replacement watch strap,
right? Like real.
This would be an e-commerce product. It could be a dropship store. It could be, which is where, and you don't hold any inventory. Maybe you just have a supplier in China, and you just kind of act as a middleman.
You never take possession of the product.
You don't, which is actually the business model that Wayfair has, and a lot of people don't know that.
Right. Yeah. No, they don't want to. I mean, yeah, I know they don't want to. Those guys came out of Cornell. I think they had like 400 websites for every product you possibly can have, and then eventually they consolidate it, right?
That sounds right to me.
Yeah. So, okay, well, let's go into your background a little bit, because I'd like to know, you know, where you grew up, kind of what your you know, background is becoming an entrepreneur, and then we can talk about some of the companies that you have owned and grown and sold, and then how you got into all the e-commerce work you did. And by the way, so you are also the host of the Rolled Up podcast, and what's the other, the e-commerce one?
Pit Stop.
And everybody should check those out on, I assume they're on all the platforms, right?
Apple, Spotify. Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Overcast.
Cool. Crowdcast. We'll put links in the show notes for
those shows as well. Wherever you listen to your podcast, if you're on some weird hipster platform, we're on there. And if we're not,
you're probably on more than me. I'm probably on the top eight or something. You're probably on more. So yeah, you can get on there. So, okay. So maybe tell me about your background and, you know, where you grew up. Were you raised and born, raised in Canada, and then how you got into entrepreneurship?
Born around Toronto, and then a city called Hamilton, then moved to a small town when I was one. Just give me a second here. I'm going to adjust my headphones.
No problem.
But apologies if you have to do a little edit here.
We don't like editing in our podcasting world. Especially the video. We don't edit the video so people can see all the behind the scenes. There you go. Like, now you can hear better.
I can move. It was caught around a bunch of stuff.
No, so you like, choking and dying on screen would not be good for my podcast.
So. It would be great.
It'd probably get a lot of views, right?
Your views would be substantially higher moving forward, and I wouldn't care because I'm dead.
Right, so Lucas Walker dies on screen. That would not be good.
Okay. You won't believe which entrepreneur died live during a recording. The host did nothing to help.
Right.
Which I think there's a plethora of lawyer jokes that could be
no question about it. As a lawyer, I could tell you there is. Yeah.
you completed all your legal obligations, but no, I moved to a small town. It was there, I think, just seeing a lot more for small businesses and really kind of breaking that you could start something from not nothing, but very little.
Your bootstrap, right? You didn't need a lot to get started.
Yeah. Or the sweaty startup of, I have a couple parents or friends, my folks who started their own business instead of kind of continuing on with their parents. And it was buying some equipment, whether it was a truck or investing in a quarry and really running a business and just seeing the passion and the purpose that it gave them, I think had to have rubbed off on me.
Yeah.
So I think that was one thing. My mother and I started a side hustle, a boutique PR agency. So I think just seeing that as an option.
Right.
And this must have been in late 90s, early 2000s. So again, just being connected to people around the world in a way that makes things possible on the internet, which is pretty cool. It's an opportunity that's not really, like, there's nothing comparable to it. So that's how I got started with my first company, Vengage. I was 23. I saw how a couple of companies had been acquired, and I'm like, the odds of winning the lottery versus building a company and selling it are
right
pretty good. And then I don't have to deal with my idiot boss, because I was young, so I wasn't paid very much, but I hated explaining to me basic shit that you should know to do the job as someone who's making twice as much as me.
Right. Yeah. No, a lot of entrepreneurs feel that way. Yeah. So what was the first company? What was your first company that started?
It was like my first legitimate company was Vengage. So the infographic maker, still around today. It's a long story of ended up leaving after about a year and just burning through a ton of money from bad advisors. Eugene, the other co-founder, actually ended up leaving as well. And it was kind of on being run with a small skeleton staff of like one person, just kind of keeping the lights on for a while. And then Eugene realized that, you know, people are coming to the website, converting. Maybe there's something to be had here. So I went back and kind of advised with Eugene for a while he was getting it kind of back up and running, doing a little bit of PR and outreach there. And then I decided that I really wanted to focus on my things. So I fully left.
And what did that company do? You said infographics. What are infographics?
Yeah, so an infographic maker. I mean, if you're listening to podcasts, you probably know what they are, but the graphics you see, maybe a chart, a data visualization. If you want to make your slides really pop, just making the data more accessible and a little bit more engaging or interesting.
Got it. Okay. And you said that company's still in business today?
Yeah, absolutely. Top startup in by LinkedIn, 70 employees. So pretty good and strong, going strong right now, which is nice.
But neither you nor your partner who founded the company are part of it anymore.
No. Eugene went back full time. Okay. And I just kind of helped out a little bit, but I'm not involved with anything at all with Vengage. I went back to get a 9-to-5 and then started my second business, which was a natural dog treat company. But I wish that story had a happy ending. It has a lot of lessons that I learned, but it doesn't really have a happy ending. And I don't love telling the story that much.
What made you go into, doesn't seem like a natural pivot to do what you were doing, to go into dog treats? How did that happen?
Yeah, I had dogs with my partner at the time, and then we started making them for ourselves, and I created a Shopify store and got a sale online from someone I didn't even know. So I thought, okay, this is interesting. This could work. And this was in like 2014, so still pretty early on, and you know, just kind of kept that momentum going and just rode that out until it didn't work.
So that was kind of a little bit of an accident. You kind of fell into it from what you were doing with your dogs.
A little bit, yeah. We figured if we were making a product for our dogs that somebody else might want them. But the CPG industry and pets specifically is very hard. Not only do you have to do a lot of things right, you need a lot of luck to get it, dealing with suppliers and packaging, big box retail, just everything to navigate.
All right. So you exited that business. There wasn't a sale or anything like that, right? You had to shut it down. And then.
Yeah. I don't really want to talk about Treats Happen, to be honest.
Yeah. No, we're not going to talk about that. So where did you go from there?
So that's when I got into Gorgeous. And I used a lot of my e-commerce experience. I've worked with a sales trainer, John Barrows, actually growing his podcast and building that up. So it was sort of that experience that I had brought. I had a lot of experience in the e-commerce space. Uh-huh. So that's when I got into Gorgeous. I think was employee number 29 there, and now they're probably 150. Ended up leaving after the big rush of 2020, sort of at the start of this year, to launch my podcast network. I could see where podcasts were going and where e-commerce was going, and I really wanted to focus on building out a network. There are so many podcasts now, and it's, I don't want to say that there's too many Me Too podcasts, but it's
right. No, there's a lot. Look at my space.
It needs to evolve.
Yeah.
It needs to evolve.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do something different with Rolled Up, and I had the opportunity to work with a top shelf producer, Emil Delich. So making a little bit more narrative, making it a little bit more, just bringing on a few layers of richness to that. And then as well, Pit Stop, making it really tactical. And if you look at it carefully, Pit Stop is the same sort of 30 to 45 minute podcast with one person, but I break it down into three episodes to make it really, we talk about one topic per episode to make it more accessible. So that if you're a founder, an e-commerce brand looking for things on, say, SEO,
right,
you can go back and look at all the SEO topics or those episodes. And then you listen to five or six episodes, get a few basic understandings of what you need to do, maybe what you're looking for, maybe get unstuck where you realize, oh, I'm making a few bad mistakes. I need to stop doing this stuff for my site. And I need to focus on this is very tactical, yeah. Very focused on the how part of the conversation to get people unstuck. And then I've got a few more pods coming to the network, one on fraud, launching a heist podcast with a magician, which I think will be pretty fun. So starting to just go more mainstream, but still, when you think about it, heists, what are heists? Well, a mail train gets robbed. A guy jumps out of a plane.
Right.
They're logistical nightmares. So
yeah,
it really ties
kind
into
of a cool topic, yeah.
To e-commerce in that sense, but it's just more interesting to then listen to, I don't know, Six Sigma Consulting on a private podcast.
Right. It's funny. I've been in talks with several groups about forming a network because I always felt that if you had a bunch of like-minded people, you'd have pooling of resources, you have bigger mail, you know, bigger distribution lists, you'd have, you know, ways to do editing as a group. I mean, there's all kinds of economies of scale that you kind of get as opposed to being on your own. A lot of us don't monetize. I certainly don't really monetize the podcast. So I don't have a lot of resources to dump money into my podcast. I got to run my law practice. That's how I pay my bills and take care of my children. So it's more of a content marketing for me than anything. So
how do you get into the podcasting for entrepreneurs as a lawyer, as a law firm? Not that you're not an entrepreneur yourself, but it's a little bit different than when you think entrepreneurs, you don't necessarily think professionals of lawyers or accountants or doctors,
right.
Even though it's the same thing. You strip away the pain, we're doing the same job.
Yeah,
like, you're running a P&L.
And it's funny you say that because I guess, at least in the United States, probably 80% or almost 90% of attorneys end up in like solo practices or small practices, whatever. Mm-hmm. They don't look at themselves as entrepreneurs. So therefore, they don't run their businesses that way. And, you know, I had a business plan challenge, I think last summer, where we would, over a 5-day period, we wrote a business plan. People, you know, win whatever to complete the thing. I had a couple of colleagues call me, should I be doing this? I'm like, yeah, you don't write things down like for your practice. It doesn't have to be like a formal business plan, but some sort of strategic planning. You just wing it and just deal with the stuff coming in the door. I mean, it's not a very well. So we're not really taught that way as professionals. That's the problem, you know?
And it's easy. And that's what the whole MBA is based off of. At least I think 50 years ago it was, you know, you're running the Quaker factory and you're being kind of promoted into management. You need to learn how to run a P&L and some basic understanding of accounting and human resources.
Yeah.
And it's not really meant to be a master's. And you see a lot of people just going and doing an MBA like right out of their undergrad. It's to fill the gaps of your professional knowledge that you don't have to take your career to the next level. At least that's how I view it.
Have those skills. Yeah. That's the problem, right? They don't even know what a P&L means. They don't know what P&L stands for. Mm-hmm. Profit and loss, and they just don't look at it that way. So that's a whole nother issue. Okay, so
I thought it was procrastinating and doing it later. I thought that's what it was.
Yeah, just pushing that's all good. I love that. Right, but that's true, right? Because people look a lot, especially professionals and attorneys. I can speak for, but you know, we go on this roller coaster ride where we bring business in and we make connections and we start working on the files that we're handling for clients, and then we stop doing the business development stuff, and then it dies down, and then we have to do it again. And it's just a constant roller coaster. You have to kind of put things in place and run yourself like a business. So you do have regular business coming in where you're dealing with the business and it's on a, you know, conveyor belt, so to speak, and it's going down the line and being worked on. And there's things coming in the pipeline at the same time, but that's why a lot of them struggle. So it's unfortunate.
It's just, you always have to be prospecting. It's just one of those
always,
things where you got to be telling someone about what you do. Even for me, it's, If I launch a podcast and the episode is really good, I'll start messaging people saying, hey, this is like, I'm proud of this. Just like, you like podcasts? Love a review.
Check it out. Right.
And it might not sound like a lot, but
no,
you get two or three reviews every day for a year.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you've got 1,000 reviews and that's pretty legitimate.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of this stuff I learned very early on, right? It's a long game and you got to have, and look, you and I both know, what is there, 1.5 million? Probably pushing on 2 million podcasts now. They're coming up every day, but very few of them are consistent where they're always putting out episodes. And I don't know what the statistic is, how many actually remain, you know, active. But it's not, you know, it's not 100%. That's for sure.
Mm.
You know,
and that's also one of the beauties of the medium is you can do a season of 8 episodes and they're still around for the next decade and people still listen.
Yeah, they stay hanging.
You don't have to keep publishing all the time.
Right.
I think that the number of active podcasts that have had 2 episodes or more released in the last, say, 90 days is drastically lower. Yes, there are podcasts, but they're not still getting any downloads or really any sort of engagement.
Yeah. Yeah, like, well, it's the same thing as any other content, right? A lot of people don't stick with things. And I think that, like you said, if you can't get 3 Google reviews and expect that to do something for you, but if you keep getting 1 a day or, you know, 1 every couple of days and it starts to build and then you have 1,000, that now you got some, now it starts doing what you want it to do, right? And people say, oh, Google reviews didn't work for me. Well, you have 5 of them. Of course, it's not going to do anything. You posted 3 times on LinkedIn. Don't tell me LinkedIn doesn't work or Facebook or whatever.
No, try that's what, every day for a month and then say it doesn't work.
That's good advice.
Maybe you don't get the results, but maybe you get something. You get some traction. You have
some movement.
A decent set of data.
Yeah, exactly. I think, that's probably a good number, right? 30 days every day. Do it 30 times. See what happens. Don't evaluate anything until you get there. Don't give it up and say, oh, this doesn't work, because people don't stick with it. And that's one of the it took, 18 months or more before I actually started to see business and connections from the podcast. You know, now I get contacted every day by PR people, other people that think of me, they need legal work, PR people for guests. I don't really have to look for guests too often. That's another. So I want to talk more about e-commerce though, because it always fascinates me, the people that kind of get in there and they start businesses. And some of them, like you said, never even take possession of products. They're just kind of drop shipping and stuff like that. So tell me what you're doing in that space, how you're helping people, what kind of things you see happening in the e-commerce platform.
A lot of it is really connecting the dots, and the tech is coming up a lot more now. So if I were to pick like a trend that's going on this year, it's not sexy, but I think inventory planning and management is going to be a big thing. And that gets into a lot of marketing strategies like discounting. Sure, you make it the sales now, but you're running out of inventory that you could have sold at a full price. And that discount that drove a lot of sales now, that took 15 points off of pure margin off your top line over the next 3-4 months. And now you're out of inventory for 2 weeks. You're not making sales anyway.
Right.
So I think that there's just a lot of heavier challenges like that you can't really talk about unless you've been through it. I've also had the privilege of working with a lot of different players in the ecosystem to just know how things work and really be able to navigate them.
Yeah.
I think that's why I really started Pit Stop, is to just create the content that wasn't there for me as a merchant and just connect people with the experts that they need to take their business to the next level. Because I mean, Facebook is changing everything with ads and email. You need different strategies and different tactics to get there. And maybe, like, you can't put all your eggs in one basket.
It's not like Google AdWords nowadays, right?
Sure, it works. Sure, one channel might have juicy margins, but if you're not looking at sort of a few channels and blending your averages, you don't really have a business. You have one channel that's referring some traffic. You're almost an affiliate marketer that knows one channel very well.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily running a business.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a good comment that as a business owner, especially if you're selling online, right, you need to pay attention to supply chain logistics, availability of product. You know, like you said, you know, the old adage is like, well, I mean, what happens if we sell too many of these things? Oh, well, these are problems we want to have, but that's not always the truth, because it could kill your business if you get to the point where, you know, your customers are leaving because they're waiting so long for product and they're going finding it elsewhere, or they're choosing something else or whatever it happens to be. And I think a lot of people, that's good advice. They don't really pay attention to the whole logistics of, I mean, look, the whole economy is suffering from that right now. There's all kinds of supply chain problems. People can't get cars and people can't get the building industry. I mean,
I just love the example because it's so like simple, is bicycles, right?
Yeah. Good
pandemic, everyone's cycling now.
Right.
There's a huge shortage. Yeah. And the number one thing that's causing it is the shortage of frames coming from Taiwan.
Right.
And even things like the Suarez Canal, when the boat was stuck there for 4 days, but now you have everything.
The ripple effect. Up.
That impacts the ports. Yeah. Now you're waiting here, you're waiting here, you're waiting here. You're waiting,
right. It's like, a huge ripple effect. Yeah.
And it's almost like
pricing, and prices go up and this and that. Yeah.
And it's, if you can even get the product.
Yeah. Like, no, I had friends that were waiting on bicycles, everything from exercise bikes to actual bicycles on the street for months. They couldn't. It was just all back. Everything was back ordered because people were, well, of course, people were home. So then they wanted to get out of their house. They didn't want to just walk all the time. What did they do? They went out and they bought bicycles. And it's hard to anticipate that kind of stuff. But if you're launching a product, you know, like you said, you can't price it pricing it too low to try and get your product out in the marketplace is fine if you always have the supply, like you said. But if you shoot yourself in the foot, you gave up margin to gain customers, and now you don't have product. You just gave all that back. Everything you've worked so hard to gain.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000. That's L-A-W to 21000 to learn how to get your own digital business card. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their affiliate link on our website to learn more and get connected with Fetch. Printify is the online service that simplifies and automates the process of sourcing and creating print-on-demand products branded with your company logo, product, or service. Printify is a better alternative to pre-purchasing and warehousing your merchandise for distribution or sale. Follow their link from our website to learn how to set up your own online store. And be sure to visit our online store and get yourself some podcast merch. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
So it's definitely, look, it's all about strategic planning, right? And people don't do that. They don't, whether you're writing a business plan or just strategic marketing plan or a strategic digital marketing plan, right? So that's one of my, look, I'm not a marketer like you are, but I think that as a small business owner and all these business owners that I meet throughout the world, they don't really have a holistic, comprehensive digital or overall marketing strategy, right? They don't have, like you said, you can't just say, let's try this and let's try that. You have to have a comprehensive plan, right? To market whatever your shop is in different channels and different ways. And then you'll, because you can't say this is working or it's not working if you have nothing to compare it to, right? So, yeah. And a lot of, they overlook that, or they dabble in this and that. And I, look, it's fine if like my law firm uses the podcast as a hub of my digital marketing, but I still have to do, you know, blogging and speaking and posting and writing. I'm working on a book, a law book, and I'm sure you do the same thing. And it's, you know, look at what you're doing with Rolled Up and the network. Mm-hmm. It's really a digital strategy, right? I mean, you're building momentum and content.
Creating a library of assets that I can then pull from and repurpose and produce more specialized stuff down the road or repurpose or revisit.
Yeah. Repurposing is great. And a lot of people don't do that. They don't realize, like you mentioned before, if you did a podcast, let's say it was six episodes, right, on one particular topic, and you didn't really go back to it so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could work out for a couple of years if you remarket it and then re-release it and make a book out of it, or maybe it was a book and it became a podcast. I don't know, whatever. And I think I don't see a lot of small business owners getting that yet. I mean, if they're working with the right kind of people, they're tied into you, they're working with other people, then they do. But a lot of them are not doing that because they have budgetary issues and they're trying to do things on their own, and they don't really get SEO. You mentioned before is a huge problem when you're trying to do this stuff on your own. I mean, SEO for dummies, you might as well be blind too, because it's such a moving thing. SEO is a constant, you know, the algorithm's changing, everything's changing. How do you get optimized? You get content out there. I mean, it's very difficult. And if you don't work in the industry as a layperson, it's very, very daunting to the person that's interested in it. It's daunting, right? To the person that's too stupid to realize, like, well, I don't know, we have a website. Okay. And it's like having a billboard on a highway. Nobody's driving down your road. And you have no clue that they're not. Law firms are huge for this. You've seen law firm websites. I'm sure Canada's the same thing. Yeah. They're all the same. They're these billboards of information that nobody's reading.
Yeah. Like you get one who's
occasionally really specifically get
like the motorcycle lawyer or the cyclist lawyer.
Right. Something specialty. Or you send somebody there because they need a lawyer and you know one of the partners or whatever. But there's no marketing funnel, so to speak.
I feel like lawyer marketing is just be everywhere all the time. Hope you're there when someone calls you, and then you make money on the referral to a better firm or a more specific firm. At least in Toronto, I've heard that's how it is for a lot.
It's kind of the same here too. And a lot of attorneys rely on other attorneys who don't work in your area to refer you business and vice versa. Mm-hmm. They do networking. They don't do a lot of marketing and it doesn't.
Well, for sure. All of the Western New York hurt in a car called William Attar,
those guys do it. Yeah.
Like that's, and then you drive to Buffalo and you hear their ads all the time. You see their ads all the time at the sporting events and you see the billboards all the time. Or
right, it's the personal injury guys.
Celino and Barnes. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to.
It's not Celino and Barnes anymore. One of them died and they split.
Oh, really?
It's like, it's like the Barnes law firm.
It was the Barnes firm for a while and they got back together.
One of them died. They might have remerged the firms, but one of them died. I think it was Barnes that died.
Wow.
Yeah, they're big down here.
Yeah, that's wild.
But you don't hear their commercials anymore. So I know it is the Barnes law firm because I do some work for them here and there for some stuff they need in New Jersey.
That's funny.
I'm
watching a show right now about some guys in New Jersey. It's an older show that's like 20 years old, so I don't know if it's still popular. It's called The Sopranos.
Yeah. Do you guys get it up there still?
Oh, yeah. It's so well written. I'm rewatching it, and it's so well written.
Those are the towns that I grew up in. That was filmed where Tony Soprano lived is a town called North Caldwell. I grew up in West Caldwell, and it's a different school system, but we all knew each other, and I know all those landmarks and all the stores. I've been to the restaurants. You know the last scene? Where he's at a place and then it goes black. Yep. That's a place called like Holston's, I think, or something. It's in Bloomfield or Clifton. I mean, all those scenes are all New Jersey and this area. Yeah, it's crazy. I think
how accurate is it? Like how real is it in terms of
in terms of the mob over here?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it's been dismantled, it was accurate at one point in time.
That's kind of how I feel watching it. It feels more like this is me how it was a while ago. And even now that the show is 20 years old, I can't see it being as accurate today. But for sure, there's still a presence.
Oh, and there's still, there's still indictments that come down and you see things on the news and stuff. But there were like 4 to 6 major crime families back when Rudolph Giuliani was the attorney general in New York. And he dismantled
before he did
all
a heel turn, to use a wrestling term.
What?
Before he did the heel turn, to use a wrestling term.
The heel turn, before he developed dementia. I don't know what happened to him, but he was like this hero in New York, and he took apart a lot of these families. And there was a lot of wars and murders and things that went back and forth. But a lot of them have dissipated. But every once in a while, I run into a client who's doing something and. Something pops up that somebody they've been doing business with is in this indictment in Queens County for this or whatever. And it's still out there. There's no question about it. They just keep, I think smartly so for them, they keep a little bit lower profile than they used to, but the Sopranos, I guess you can get it streaming on HBO.
And it's just, it's just so well written and the cinematography in it is just there's a reason that HBO is HBO.
There was a scene where I think there was like a senator or something that Tony was influencing and he was cheating on his wife with a girlfriend. And there was a scene at her condo, whatever. It was in my dad's complex. They like blocked off this whole section you couldn't drive into except for unless you lived there. And they filmed a lot of it at night, but they put up these huge lights to make it seem like it's daytime. And there was all these trucks and the catering trucks and everything. It was crazy.
Well, that's like Suits going.
Suits. I like that show too.
Suits is filmed in Toronto.
Yeah.
And I really like that episode where Mike almost gets found out. That was a good one.
Yeah. But is it situated in Toronto or they're just filming up?
It's set in New York.
Yeah. Right.
But filmed in Toronto. But then they always give like these little winks to Toronto.
Yeah,
and
little,
if you watch
Easter eggs, right?
Yeah, you can see all the buildings, and you know it's Toronto if you're from here, and it's like, oh yeah, I know that bar, and it's the same thing of, oh yeah, these are all the spots. But
yeah, it's funny now that you mention it. I never really associated that with New York because there's no backdrop to anything in New York. See a little bit of it, I guess, here and there.
It's an office, but it could be any like major downtown core. It could be Boston, Chicago, Toronto, any sort of.
And I'm sure it's much easier to film in Toronto than New York.
Toronto has a huge film industry. So tons of government grants and just like the crew that can do it is the other thing too.
They get the
it's
people.
Like films that are like big productions. You need a lot of bodies to know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's funny. We started running out of content on TV during the pandemic. And now there's so many streaming shows. It's ridiculous. You can't even keep up with all the stuff. And I've had some great stuff out of Canada. There's a series called Kim's Convenience. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's up there, right? It's Toronto.
I'm on the last season.
Yeah, I just finished season 5, right?
The convenience store was for sale, yeah. And it's funny, it was actually filmed during COVID, which you can't tell at all, which is
they didn't really acknowledge.
They still have customers coming in. Sometimes you can tell because they kind of strip down the cast or everyone's really far away.
Right. But
yeah, no, it's filmed in Toronto, and the season finale of Rolled Up, I'm actually talking to a convenience store owner who it's really interesting with Uber Eats and everything, just how he might get 100 orders from Uber Eats.
Really?
But the whole dynamics of it that, you know, you have to bring the wholesaler a bottle and kind of like play their games, a little bit old school, and then just trying to get different products that differentiate you if you have snacks and just being like hyper local, really marketing that way. But if you get a big flash zone, you get an extra 120 orders, even with Uber Eats taking their cut, you still have
money, right?
It makes you money and you're turning inventory over so you can go back to the wholesaler and keep buying more cases and just being a better customer to them, which then gets you better products, more exclusives, more exotics, which can then drive more customers into your store.
Now, what is Uber Eats picking up at a convenience store?
All kinds of stuff. Snacks.
Chips and snacks and whatever.
Snacks, ice cream, groceries, some exotics.
Yeah.
Just like 2-bite brownies, whatever.
I guess convenience stores really are hyper-local. Like that's how they survive because they don't really have that much differentiation. If you go to 3 convenience stores in your area, they're basically going to have the same stuff, right?
I think that they made their establishment selling like smokes and papers. Just people would buy their dailies or your essentials if you're out of milk
and you don't want to go to the supermarket and nobody cares about the brand. And, you know, you're just buying whatever you're buying. You're paying more, which is fine, but that's how I always looked at it. But I didn't even think about that. Like Uber Eats, I guess, can go anywhere you want to go, right? And if
you have a good selection of exotic products, it's another channel. And then it turns it over so that you get better pricing on your staples and your milk from the wholesaler.
Right. Yeah, because you don't have really an incremental cost of using them. You're not hiring new staff. You're not bringing in more product. Even the more product doesn't matter if you're buying it, whatever. But it doesn't increase your rent. There's no other fixed overhead that you get from using Uber Eats, and clearly whatever people are ordering, if they were local, they wouldn't have spent the extra money. They'd get it themselves. So it probably doesn't affect your business. Your business probably doesn't go down. It just adds to whatever you're selling locally, right?
Yeah. And it's a new customer. It's a new customer discovery platform as well.
Yeah.
They might order on Uber Eats and then swing by. They didn't realize it was so close or that you had a good selection. So if you're having a party or whatever, get some exotics, just like funky snacks.
Like it popped up on the app and they're like, oh, I didn't realize that was here. And they order something and Well, that's a good way that shows that, you know, local retail businesses that have hard footprints can benefit from e-commerce because even though they may not sell all over the country, it raises awareness to people that didn't even realize you were there and they're a couple blocks away or a couple miles away, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, really, Uber Eats is no different than selling on Amazon. It's a marketplace.
Yeah.
That takes care of your logistics for you. That's exactly what it is.
What it is, right?
It's the exact same business model. And to go full circle to our friends Tony Soprano, who likes to eat his gabagool.
Yeah.
They're taking a percentage of revenue. They're getting points.
Right.
There are really three kinds of businesses that take points: taxes, mob, and platforms. Like look at Apple taking 30 points from app developers and not letting you install elsewhere.
The old credit card processing model, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want us to process the business, you know, you get paid. We're going to take a percentage off the top.
Yeah.
That's the same type of thing. So it kind of brings us back full circle to e-commerce, right? Because clearly anybody can benefit from e-commerce if they just think about the strategy properly. But so let's talk about the business though, because I think that one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you and what was attractive to me is that the pandemic really shifted us to doing online shopping, even hyper-local shopping, right? A lot of us, even to this day, are buying groceries and either having them delivered or showing up at the store and waiting until they put it in your trunk and you drive away. Those days of contactless, and it's all through the web, it's all through mobile applications, and it's much easier to do than it used to be, right? So I was wondering your thoughts about that. What do you see the trends up there and around the world in terms of where this is all going?
I think it'll come back a little bit, but it will continue to rise over the next decade. If you look at book sales online,
Amazon,
which is how they started,
right?
It's a staple item that you know what it costs. Book sales online in the US plateaued at about 30-ish%. I don't know the exact number. It might be 32, it might be 35, but that's the number. It's not 100% of sales are online.
Right.
So I think that there's, and I think e-commerce sales is about 25% right now, but books are just a nice stable product.
Right.
It's pretty
Does that
convenient.
Include electronic copies like Kindle and things like that or no?
I don't know.
Because I've noticed, I don't know about up by you, but I've noticed bookstores that don't exist anymore. Like we still have Barnes & Noble.
But they sell tchotchkes.
They sell other things. They have Starbucks and whatever. So there was a chain called Borders. They're gone. I mean, there's no really other bookstores. Local bookstores basically have closed as a few of them, but they're hard. It's hard for them to stay in business.
I think it's specialty. A lot of the used market as well. I'm a bit of a collector of books, like here.
Real books.
Oops. Like this one here is a nice vintage copy of Ogilvy on Advertising. So I'm always just like looking for the classics on just nice original print. Sometimes you get kind of cool things or little stuff. Somebody highlighted this, which kind of sucks, but
yeah, but that was from a used store. And there's some used bookstores in my town too. Yeah.
So, and even used bookstores can sell on Amazon and other marketplaces too. So if you're on the aftermarket, that's where a lot of the money can be, depending on what you're looking for. It just opens up so many more markets.
Right. All right. So if I'm a business owner, an entrepreneur, right, small business owner, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing, right, I'm selling stuff locally. How do I get started in e-commerce? What's the easiest way for me to get started? How should I get started? What do I do first?
Start collecting emails. Email is what pays the bills, whether it's driving people to your product page or to your store. People are just a lot more forgiving when they when they know you a little bit and they're a little bit more familiar with you. So email by far is the best way. And then have some sort of way for people to be able to purchase with Apple Pay or a saved credit card somewhere.
Probably gather their email address.
Their phone. Right? Make sure that it's friendly. And then that's it. Have an email and say, have a way for them to buy and say, hey, do you want to buy this stuff?
Yeah.
If not, tell me why. And then take that feedback and keep iterating.
Yeah. So two questions. One, I could have paid you to say that. I think one of the shortest comings that business owners miss is that growing an email list, even if you're a retail store, you ever have like a fishbowl, and they're giving away a free lunch or a free smoothie or whatever. You put your card in there. You don't win the lunch. You never hear from them again. Like these people have come. They said, hey, we're patronizing your store here. I'm raising my hand and I don't end up any sort of a marketing list. And I think that was even something I learned early on in podcasting.
Well, even that.
Emails to grow your list, you know?
Yeah. And even that, if you just contacted everyone who put the fishbowl and said, hey, we're closed this Saturday for everyone except you because you put your email in our fishbowl. Come on down for VIP lunch. People feel special. They tell their friends about it. Then they come back and they feel that connection. So they keep coming back there maybe one or two more times and they're still paying full price, full margin, but you sold out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, email marketing lists are gold because like you said, you contact them, you share them information, you stay in touch. They know you're in business. They think of you. And I think that is a huge, you have to build a marketing list. You really do. And people don't do that. Now, if I'm going to start a store, let's say I sell my products, I don't really sell them online. What's the easiest way for me to get started to set up an e-commerce store?
Shopify. $29. You set it up. It goes through everything. You can do it in a couple of hours. It won't be pretty, but it works.
It'll be a start.
Which is pretty cool.
Right. Right. But as you develop and as you start selling things, then you can move up to, you know, better products, yeah, working with a professional.
Or even just like taking a design course or a copywriting course, reading a couple books on it. Just, you read a book on design and a book on copywriting, you can make a site that's good enough. Wait until, and then like that'll get you to your first million in revenue. And then once you hit that, then that's when you can start trying to find experts and growing.
And are there, if I'm looking to get started in e-commerce, I don't own a business. So I'm like, well, you know, it sounds like e-commerce. I don't have to rent a store, right? I don't need real estate. I don't have to sign a lease, whatever. Are there any trends that you see like products and or industries where e-commerce is growing, where there's opportunities, or is it just a really crowded space?
Everywhere. It's everywhere. The industry is just growing so fast. The opportunity has never been better. That's not to say that it's easy. Everything's hard. Everything's competitive. Right. I'm sure you, as a lawyer, a lot of lawyers go through law school thinking, oh, I can go through law school, I'll be set for life for a job.
Oh, yeah, I'll have a job and it'll be no problem. It's very competitive.
Not so much. It's incredibly hard and difficult, but it can be a good career in a number of different ways, whether it's on the software, app development, product, consulting, copywriting, ad buying, building the stores yourselves. There's a lot of pie to contribute to. So you don't need to do everything from end to end, which is nice.
And how would somebody, advice for people, how would they go about sourcing products? Like, what's a good way to find products that they may want to sell that are available?
I would say,
You basically have to connect as a wholesaler, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it depends. You can just call wholesalers or different marketplaces. I think I really want to refrain from saying Alibaba or AliExpress, but it's a great start.
And yeah. Because that's international, Alibaba, right?
It is, but like, it's not that hard to import. It's easier than you think, but you contact them. And I would say contact like 20 suppliers, spend a week and contact a few a day, see what they say, ask them some hard questions that whether or not you want to tour their facility, say, hey, can I come and see your facility within the next 6 weeks?
Right.
And if they say yes, it's a good indicator. They say, we don't allow people to come in. Then, well, they might just be brokering and you're not going to have that. So just asking them the questions, doing a small order, making sure it sells. It's better to sell out than be sitting on inventory. And then eventually, as you grow, more and more suppliers will start to find you, which is nice because sometimes they have access to different things, trade shows. You can find suppliers there,
right?
Whether it's virtual or in person.
Yeah, you have more access to trade shows now, right? Because some of them are virtual.
Well, that's it. And even just seeing the list of booths and stuff, sometimes you can just say, hey, I'm thinking of buying a ticket. Can I get a list of vendors who will be there? You just call them up and say, hey, I can't make it, but I'd love to talk to your sales team. Like, no vendor's going to say, oh, no, we only buy through this stuff. I mean, it might happen. I once had a packaging supplier say, oh, no, we have a $250,000 minimum order. Cool. I'm never going to do business with you because I had to follow up with you and you told me to fuck off. Sorry for making you edit, but like, that's my one.
We don't have to edit. It's an adult podcast.
There are no children listening to this. If you're a child listening to this, congratulations. Right. You're going to be pretty well set up, but maybe
you're starting at the right
friends
age
or something. You got time for this in your 20s.
All right. Well, Lucas, I know you're on a tight time schedule and we'll leave it at that, we'll put in the show notes how people can get in touch with you and connect with you on the podcast and learn about e-commerce and all the stuff you're doing. I hope you have a good summer up in Toronto. And is there any final parting words that you want to share?
Yeah.
People should get in touch with you, whatever.
Yeah. If you've enjoyed this, make sure you leave a review of Mitch's podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you're listening. And if you want to hear a little bit more of me, go down my rabbit hole to search for Lucas Walker right after you leave that review. I'm on all the platforms.
All right, Lucas, I can't thank you enough for giving me the time and let's definitely stay in touch.
Absolutely. Cheers, Mitch.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.